a little bit talking about dynamics in the generalized formalism. And then we're going to move on to the next topic where I want to give a little bit of a philosophical background that will be useful for understanding what's going on in the next week and also when we talk about interpretations. So I know that a lot of physicists are allergic to philosophy, but I'm sorry, there will be some words on the slides later on. All right, okay, so we were talking about the generalized formalism and we got up to about, well, we got up to about here, halfway through here, talking about CPT maps. Oh dear, has PowerPoint crashed again? Yeah. PowerPoint really likes to crash on me. Let's hope it doesn't do it again. Talking about CPT maps from the Church of the Larger Hilbert Space point of view. So, no, this isn't working. Great. It's not one thing, it's another thing. All right. Go away. Let me just give the lecture from the PDF version of the slides then. That will hopefully sort that out. Excuse me for a second. Okay, hopefully PDF will be better. All right, so where we were the last time is, so whatever, if we're interested in the dynamics of a subsystem of a larger system that's embedded in an environment, then we have to derive that by applying the unitary transformation to the system and the environment, and then tracing out the environment. And we discovered that this gives an operator some representation for the dynamics on the density operator, where these operators here are defined in terms of a basis, the initial states of the environment, basis states for the environment, and the unitary interaction. And then we ask the question, okay, what sets of operators can arise in this way? And the answer is any set of operators that such that when you sum MJ dagger MJ, you should get the identity. Okay, so that's where we were. And then I started to talk about this, yeah.
So what is in this church,
yeah.
What is unitary, the temporal evolution is unitary,
yeah.
But in the complete system, right?
Temporal evolution is unitary in principle on the entire universe, right?
Yeah.
But then if we look at a subsystem of the universe, we don't see unitary evolution because it may be interacting with an environment.
Yes.
That's the story. Okay. Oh, all right, okay. So, oh yes, all right. So then we started to talk about the Church of the Smaller Hilbert Space view. So if you view states as just being things that assign probabilities in a well-defined way to observables, then whatever dynamics is, it should map states on the input space to states on the output states. And then we said that the dynamics should preserve convex mixtures because one way of preparing this convex mixture is to flip a coin and with a bias P and decide whether to prepare rho A or rho sigma. Rho A or sigma A, depending on the outcome of that coin flip. And then that coin flip is completely independent of the system, so you'd expect whatever happens to this density operator should be a convex mixture of these two. And then that implies that we can extend it to a linear map from the linear operators on A to the linear operators on B. So that means that what we're dealing with is what's sometimes called a superoperator. It's an operator on the linear operators from HA to the linear operators from HB. Okay, so it's an operator on operators. Okay, so then we looked at this decomposition a bit. So the linear operators on A, we can expand as HA tensor HA dagger. Here I'm giving them different numerical indices because it'll be useful to keep track of which one's which one corresponds to which of these two spaces as we continue here. And the output space is the linear operators on B, which is HB2 tensor HB1 dagger. Okay, so then the linear operators on the linear operators is the same thing as the linear operators from this space to this space. Okay. And then we can say, well, the linear operators from a Hilbert space to another Hilbert space are just the output Hilbert space tensor the dagger of the input Hilbert space. So the output Hilbert space is just this one, and then we take the dagger of the input Hilbert space. So we get that these operators on operators are equivalent to elements of this tensor product of four Hilbert spaces. Okay, so you can see we have kets on A1, bras on A2, bras on B1, and kets on B2. So it's going to be some object like this with some components. Okay, and in abstract index notation, we have the each of A and B have one upper and lower index, but whether one is upper or lower depends on whether you're A or B. Right? And this is what it looks like as a box. And then if we want to think, see this diagram here looks more like it's supposed to look as a physical operation. It's a map from system A to system B. And we get that by treating these objects here as the kets of our system. All right. Any questions about that? All right, okay. So now the action of on a density operator is just going to be, as always, contract the indices. So if you have a density operator on A, it has two A indices. You have to contract the A indices, basically. So this is what it looks like in the red diagram. It's just rho is an input that goes through E. Okay, so that's going to look like this. We're just sticking the density operator between the A indices here, and that's the contraction. Okay. Now, the next thing we said was that we can actually decompose this space in a different way. Okay, so we started with this, and then we wrote it out as a tensor product of four components, but we can do something different. So if instead of grouping the A indices with the B indices, we group the one indices together and the two indices together, then the first thing we see is that, okay, this guy is the linear operators from B1 to A1, right? So this is the dagger of B1. And this is the linear operators from A to B. But the linear operators from B to A are the dual to the linear operators from A to B. So this is the dagger of a Hilbert space, tensor producted with the Hilbert space. This is, again, a space of linear operators. Now the input and output spaces are the same, so it's just the linear operators on the linear operators from H to from A to B. Okay, so this is a different way of decomposing it. So in this decomposition, all I've done here is just moved around the terms, right? So if I write the A terms together and the B terms together in this way, then I put the density operator here in the middle, like that. That's basically all we do. But now I want to view the linear operators from A to B as my space of kets. So this is different. Previously, I was viewing the linear operators on A as a space of kets. Now from A to B, so I'm going to call those the blue kets, and from B to A as my bras, then this has a form that looks like this. Okay, this is a bra. This is a ket. And the action on a density operator, when you put a density operator in the middle, is just this kind of thing. All right. Now, the point is that if we can show that this is a positive operator in this space, so that means if I take a vector in this space, which is just a linear operator from A to B, if I sandwich the super operator between those two vectors, if I find that that's positive, then it means it's a positive operator on that space. Okay? If it's a positive operator on that space, it means it has positive eigenvalue. It means, well, it's diagonalizable and it has positive eigenvalues. So we will be able to find some diagonal decomposition like this, where these are positive eigenvalues. And then if I just decide to absorb the normalization, like make these non-normalized and absorb the eigenvalue into the definition of these operators, then it would look like this. And remember, the action in this kind of decomposition, the action on rho is you stick rho between the ket and the bra, right? So if you have this kind of decomposition, then that immediately gives you the operator sum decomposition that we're looking for. Okay, so the big challenge is to prove that you have that positivity, then everything else is automatic. However, if you have this operator sum decomposition, then it's easy to prove that you have to have this condition, that you have to sum to the identity. The reason being that we want our output to be a density operator, so the trace of the output has to be the trace, same as the trace of the input, which is 1. And this is the definition of what it means for this to be a trace-preserving operator, trace-preserving super-operator, rather. So here's how you show that that's equivalent to this condition. So first of all, if this condition holds, then it's easy to see that if I take the trace of the output, if I use the cyclic property of the trace and move this around, then if that is the identity, then I get the same as the trace of the input. That's good. On the other hand, suppose this is a trace-preserving operator, and let's take just any projector onto a pure state as our density operator, then we have to have this condition, okay? And then I can use the cyclic property of the trace again to write it as an inner product like this. So this says, since we could use any psi here, we know that for any psi, this thing here is equal to 1, okay? So actually means that, psi n psi is 1, with n being this operator here. Okay, so that, but that implies that this itself has to be the identity. Why? Well, here's the proof. So if you have psi n psi equal 1 for all unit vectors, then n is equal to the identity. Why? If we choose psi as a basis vector, then you find that the diagonal elements have to equal 1. So diagonal elements of that matrix are equal to 1. And now we can choose to make two other choices. We can choose psi is equal to this guy, equal superposition of basis vectors, and this one where I put an I in there. So if I work out what that is, then I get this equation. And if I work out what this is, then I get that equation. And so if I take the sum of those two equations, then you see that the off-diagonal elements are all 0. Okay, so that means that once I have this condition, I know that this operator has to be the identity. All right, so that's trace preserving sorted out. Now we have to deal with this positivity business, and this is a bit embarrassing. So it would be really nice if we could show that this positivity followed from the requirement that the output is a positive operator. Okay, just that the output is a density operator, really. A superoperator that satisfies that constraint is called a positive superoperator, but that's not what happens. That's not enough. Okay, so what happens is slightly embarrassing for this Church of the Smaller Hilbert space, because we have to introduce an additional system. The point is that if our system that we're acting on is correlated with some environment, then when we act on the system alone, we should have that the system and the environment also stays in the valid state. Okay, and it turns out that that condition is stronger than just positivity on the system. So a superoperator with this property is called completely positive. Okay, let's say why that's the case. Let's give an example of a superoperator that's positive but not completely positive. Here's one that's the transpose map. So what it does to a basis vector is it just flips the order, right? So it, in matrix notation, all it's going to do is flip the rows and the columns of the matrix. Okay, so here the input and output have the same dimension, so it's just mapping the components. You switch the two indices. Obviously, if you have, for example, a Hermitian operator, and you flip flip the indices, the eigenvalues are going to stay the same. Right. Hence, if it's a positive map because it maps something with positive eigenvalues to something with positive eigenvalues. Okay, but now let's assume that everything's qubits, and let's consider an initial state that's correlated with the environment, just a maximally entangled state. And then, so that's the maximally entangled state. And then when we act the transpose on it, just on system A, okay, so this is going to get switched with this, but that's 0, 0. This is going to get switched with this, so I get 1, 0, 0, 1. Here I'm going to get 0, 1, 1, 0, and that one's going to stay the same. Now you can see that this operator has a negative eigenvalue, because if I act with this on here, then what does it do? It switches 0, 1, and 1, 0. If I switch 0, 1, and 1, 0, I get an eigenvalue of minus 1. So that's not a positive, it's not positive anymore. So this has an eigenvalue of minus a half, because of this half factor here. Therefore, the output isn't a positive operator. So having the system correlated with the environment still maintain positivity is a stronger requirement than just having the system remain positive. Okay. So for complete positivity, we require that this is a positive operator for any positive input that's correlated with the environment, which means that if I take the sandwich of the output with any state on the output system and the environment, it should be a positive number. So in particular, let's choose as our input state this delta. Delta, remember, being just the unnormalized maximally entangled state. So delta AE is just this guy. Right. If I choose that as the input state, oh, I wrote it out there. Okay, fine. This turns out to be equivalent to the positivity constraint that we want, right? The one that I was talking about before. So when I treat when I think of see I can convert this. Well, we'll see this in diagrams in a minute. But you can convert this state on this tensor product into an operator using the state operator duality that we talked about last time. Okay, so let's see how that works. It's much easiest in diagrams, right? So our input state is this maximally entangled state here, and we have the projector here, right? And we have to contract indices with E, okay? Then we have to take the inner product here with the bra and with the ket here. Okay, so that's the object that we have. Now what we can do is we can basically use it's a state operator duality to take this wire and bend it up, and then I have to bend it down again. So really, I'm turning this identity wire via the yanking axiom into one of those cups connected to a cap. Okay, so I'm going to do that on this side too. I'm going to take this B wire and turn it into a cup connected to a cap. I think I'm doing that, yeah, that's the B wire. I've changed the order of A and B from here to here. This is now A and this is B. Okay, so now let's look inside these boxes. Inside these boxes, we have exactly the state operator duality, right? So this is how, if I take a state, I can create an operator from it, similarly here, right? So I can replace inside these dotted line boxes with this, which is exactly the positivity condition we need. And if you're not convinced by that, you should, because it's much easier to see what's going on. This is the same thing using index notation. So all I'm doing is I put in some delta operators to lower this index and raise this index, then these become operators, okay? So that's exactly the condition we needed. And then we see that that Krauss decomposition, the operator sum decomposition, is really just the eigen decomposition of an operator that acts on this space. Okay. Okay, so we now have proved that a completely positive trace preserving map must have this form, the same as we proved from the Church of the Larger Hilbert space. However, I only showed you that it was positive when I put in that delta state. So I have to, we have to confirm that this is positive for all input states. Now, since this is a positive operator, I can define its square root. Square root just means take the square roots of the eigenvalues, leave the eigenvectors the same. Then I can see that this object here, if I take this, decompose this into two square roots, it's just this, it's of the form of n dagger, the sum n, so it's a positive operator. And then this is just a sum of positive operators, and the sum of positive operators is obviously still going to be positive. So we're done, right? Positivity being positive on this input was sufficient to be positive on everything. All right, so to summarize what we've done, a physical map from density operators to density operators must be of this form, where these guys sum to the identity. We can derive this in two ways. We can derive it from saying the system acts unitarily with its environment, in an environment that is initially uncorrelated with, or from the requirement that the map must be completely positive, so this is positive for all positive inputs, and trace preserving. Basically, just saying that it has to be a map from states to states, and it must do that even if you're correlated with the environment. Okay, so this is kind of two different perspectives on the same thing. Again, Church of the Larger Hilbert space and Church of the semi-smaller Hilbert space, because this environment here is still a little bit embarrassing from that point of view. Any questions about any of that? Okay, just to give you some examples of what these things look like, if you have non-unitary dynamics, things can happen. Well, so unitary dynamics of a qubit is really just a rotation of the Bloch sphere. But if you have a CPT map, you can do other things. So one example is a depolarizing channel. Depolarizing channel basically with certain probability P just replaces your state with maximally mixed state, and with 1 minus p does nothing. They might say, oh, that doesn't look like a Krauss form, but you can check that here's a Krauss decomposition of that particular operation. The Krauss operators are the identity and proportional to the identity and the three Pauli operators. And what that operation does, well, it's just every state gets replaced by a convex combination with the maximally mixed state and the original state, so it just basically shrinks the entire Bloch sphere down. Another one, which is another map here, which is relevant, particularly relevant for decoherence theory, is this one. You take two Krauss operators like this. So basically what this does, it's a little bit tricky to exactly say what these parameters do, but what this does is it shrinks your Bloch sphere down to an ellipsoid, right? So it keeps the same dimension in the sigma 3 direction, but the other two directions shrink down. Okay, the reason why this is relevant to decoherence is that you want, when you have a classical limit, you want to be able to replace your coherent superpositions by just a mixture of two definite states. So here you can see this is kind of what's happening in the extreme limit. It would get crunched down to just a line, just a mixture of the zero and one states. So this kind of effect we'll see later is relevant to why we don't see macroscopic Schrodinger cats and stuff like that. Any questions about that? Okay, let's have a look at how we're doing for time. I have, Okay, maybe I will do this next. I was deciding whether I was going to actually cover this next section, but maybe I will go through it at least quickly. this is again going to be relevant to decoherence theory. So, so far what we've done is we've talked about discrete time dynamics. But what about continuous time dynamics? When we think about Unitary dynamics in quantum theory, we have the Schrödinger equation, and we can say what happens continuously in time. So first of all, let's just look at what the dynamics of a density operator is under unitary evolution. So this is how a density operator evolves under unitary evolution. And let's suppose that this unitary is generated by some fixed Hamiltonian. Okay, so we run the Hamiltonian for a time between t naught and t, then it looks like this, okay? And then in order to figure out the equation of motion, we just expand this Hamiltonian to first order in time, like this. So that's what it looks like to first order. And we're trying to find the derivative of this with respect to time, so I'm subtracting rho of t. We only keep the first order terms. If we only keep the first order terms here, we get something that looks like a commutator. Well, it is a commutator, and this is the equation that we end up with. You may have seen it before. That's called the von Neumann equation. It's basically 100% equivalent to the Schrödinger equation. Like, if I put in a pure state, it is the same thing as the Schrödinger equation, just done on the level of density operators. But this equation, if you have unitary evolution of a density operator, continuous time unitary evolution, this is the equation that you use. Okay. What about continuous time dynamics? So we know that actually finite time dynamics doesn't need to be unitary. We know that now that we can have a completely positive trace preserving map that looks like this. So what's the corresponding continuous time dynamics? Now there's a bit of a subtle issue here, which is you might have thought that we could just say, okay, let's do what we did last time. Let's see, here I parameterized the unitary by t, a continuous parameter t, and saw what I got. So you might thought, okay, let's just parameterize this by t. And let's suppose that if we evolve up to time t, and then we evolve up to another delta t, then that's just the composition. So first we apply the dynamics up to t, and then we apply the extra delta t, right? You might have thought that's reasonable. That sort of says this. So basically, we would have a family of CPT maps, which depend on a parameter, a real parameter. This would give it the structure of a continuous semigroup. Don't worry too much about what that is if you don't know. It just basically means this, composition rule. But however, there's a problem with this point of view. We can't naively adopt this point of view from the point of view of the Church of the Larger Hilbert space. So let's see what the problem is. So recall that when we were deriving things in the Church of the Larger Hilbert space, we assumed that the system was initially uncorrelated with its environment. We started off with this kind of state, okay? And the problem is that if I have a unitary evolution between the system and the environment, then typically at this stage, it will no longer be in a product state between the system and the environment, okay? So if we want to have this kind of thing, if I want to be able to chop up my evolution into time elements of delta t and just compose them like this, we would need the system to be uncorrelated with its environment at that stage, because that's the only conditions under which we have so far derived that CPT maps hold for unitary evolution. And that won't be true in general, okay? So we will have to assume that the interaction with the environment basically approximately looks like this. So you interact for a very short period of time. After that period of time, you completely discard the environment. You throw it in the trash. You bring in another environmental system in some fixed state, and then you do the interaction again and repeatedly do that for very short periods of time. So this will only hold if the system behaves as if it's interacting with a new uncorrelated environment at every time step. There's a physicist name for this, this particular approximation. It's called the weak coupling limit. And what we really mean is that this will approximately hold, if the environment at least approximately acts as if it's, the correlations are extremely weak. Is the point. So the kind of system in which this holds is, for example, suppose your environment is a thermal bath, so it's just some maybe some photons which are in thermal equilibrium or something like that. Then there's a time scale for the rethermalization of the bath, right? So when you interact with the bath, you're going to knock it slightly out of the thermal equilibrium state, but then it's a very, very big system, so it's going to equilibrate very, very quickly. So if that time scale for rethermalization is a lot shorter than the time scale on which the system gets significantly correlated with the environment. Okay, so this interaction is acting slowly compared with the rate of rethermalization of the bath, then this kind of approximation is good. Any questions about that? A puzzle.
So why can't we just have them be correlated?
You can have them be correlated, but then So this is actually quite an interesting question that is still subject of current research, which is how do we describe the dynamics of a system that's initially correlated with its environment? Because the point is that when you have this, it's sort of it's not entirely obvious that we can even get to a description which is in terms of the system alone, right? Because how the system gets correlated with the environment, the point is that if I want to think of something as a dynamical map, I have to be able to change the state of the system and see what happens. But here, when I change the state of the system here, it means that it's going to be correlated with the environment in different ways, and it gets sort of complicated to handle. So I'm not saying you can't do that. I'm saying that you won't get the kind of standard form of the equation, and it's still sort of a bit of an open question as to what happens in general.
Why can't you just do a unitary evolution on combined system and environment?
You of course can, but what we're trying to do is like say under what circumstances I can just deal with the system on its own. So we're in a situation where we basically want to ignore the environment. The environment's like some large thermal system or something like that, which we don't particularly care about. We care about the system, so we don't want to keep track of the environment unless we absolutely have to. In general, you always can do that, of course. Okay. So this is what we're going to do. Okay, so in this situation, we will have an operator sum decomposition, right? So if I evolve up to time t, then evolve for an extra time delta t, there'll be some operator sum decomposition, and we expect, if this is continuous in time, this to give us the initial state plus some terms which are of order delta t. Now, it's really complicated. So to derive the equation I'm going to tell you about with full rigor is quite involved and complicated. You can find it in various textbooks. We're going to take a bit of a shortcut, at least motivate the form of this thing. So the point is, what we want to do is expand each term in this decomposition up to order delta t to see what happens. Now, I don't think I told you this before, but there is the Kraus decomposition of a CPT map is not unique, right? There are different decompositions that give the same CPT map. In particular, I can take a unitary combination of different Kraus operators. So if I define nk as ukj mj, sum over j, I define a set of Kraus operators like this just by a unitary combination of the other ones, then you can prove that gives you the same CPT map. So by doing this, it turns out, and it's like a little bit tricky to prove, but we can generally put all of the order one term, so this term here, in a single Kraus operator. So basically, you can make the first Kraus operator, let's call it M0, be the one that has the identity component. The identity and the identity here are what's going to give you this term. Okay. And then it's going to have an order delta t term. And that order delta t term will be some operator. But what I want to do is decompose it into two Hermitian operators. Right? So for any general operator, I can always write it as like the decomposition of complex number into real and imaginary parts. I can always decompose it into two Hermitian operators, one of which is multiplied by I. So I'm just going to call these two operators L0 and minus H. The reason for the minus sign is, as you might imagine, this term is going to end up being the Hamiltonian of the system. So we can always do that. Now, these terms, these operators now have no terms of order one, right? So if they're going to contribute at all, their largest order, the smallest order term needs to be of order square root of delta t. Because if their smallest term was delta t, I'd do it on both sides, so it would be order delta t squared. So the only way for the other ones to contribute is if they have a term of order square root delta t. Then if they have a term of order delta t, it doesn't matter because that's just going to contribute higher than delta t order. Okay. All right, so now we just plug these terms into this equation, saying that this must give the dynamics. So you plug that in and you find, we're going to try and find the derivative of this thing. So we're going to subtract rho t from rho t plus delta t. That gives you this. Okay, all terms of order delta t. And then we can rewrite that as, okay, so first of all, we're going to have a commutator between h and rho here from these two terms. This is the same as the term that we had in the von Neumann equation. And then you have an anti-commutator between L0 and rho from here. And then you just have these terms, which sort of looks like the action of a CPT map. Okay, so this is the final equation that you get. This is called, well, actually, it's not the final thing yet. Okay, because we've imposed so far that we have a CPT map. For finite times, we have a CPT map. What we have not imposed is the trace preserving condition that the sum of MJ dagger MJ has to be the identity. We still have to impose that. So we look at M naught dagger M naught, and that's this complicated thing. We keep the terms of order delta t, and we find that that is the identity plus 2L naught, basically. And then if I take the sum of these other ones to first order, I just get LJ dagger LJ. So this plus this has to be the identity. If that's going to be the case, this L0 operator has to be determined by these other LJ operators. Okay, so so this commutator between anti-commutator between L0 and rho can alternatively be written as half the sum of these guys anti-commutator with rho. Okay. So now, in principle, if I choose any set of n operators LJ and a Hamiltonian, this will always give me a continuous, completely positive trace-preserving evolution. And this equation is called the Lindblad equation. So let me just give an example. Let's suppose that you have a Hamiltonian zero. The Hamiltonian is zero, the system isn't evolving unitarily at all, it's just interacting with the environment. And let's suppose we have a single Lindblad operator, so we just have one of these guys, and it's proportional to the Z Pauli operator. Okay, so if you stick this into this whole mess of an equation, it gets simple because we only have like one term here and one term there that you have to work out. You find that it looks like this. So the rate of change of rho with respect to time is this. This is a matrix equation. So so if we look at what happens component-wise, so the derivative of each of these terms is what happens if I apply this matrix operation here. So you can see that what's happening is the diagonal elements don't change at all. And the off-diagonal elements, they're going to decay. We're going to get an exponential decay here, right? Because this rate of change is proportional to the rate of change of rho 1, 0 is proportional to rho 1, 0 with some negative constant. Okay. So the solution to that equation is just exponential decay. And you can see that basically what's going to happen here is that the off-diagonal elements are going to decay. And the on-diagonal elements will just stay where they are. So again, this is relevant, right? So if this is if this zero versus one is really a macroscopic system, cat alive versus cat dead, if you have an interaction with the environment that causes this kind of interaction, then these terms, which are going to be responsible for the interference, possibility of viewing interference between those two terms, are going to decay. So this is, when we talk about the classical limit, we'll look at things that have this kind of form. Any questions about that? All right. So for the last 20 minutes, we're going to switch topics. We've basically finished with the, by the way, I presented basically a Church of the Larger Hilbert space derivation of this. Well, it was kind of a bit of a mishmash between the two. The reason is I haven't really thought about, I don't think there is in the literature yet a very clean derivation of this, which is only Church of the Larger Hilbert space or only Church of the Smaller Hilbert space. So that's something that's still to think about. Yeah.
So in here, H is the Hamiltonian of the entire system.
Right. So something funny sometimes happens, right? So H would be, you want to think of H as a Hamiltonian acting only on the system. Okay. So in reality, you have a system and an environment. System has an internal Hamiltonian, environment has an internal Hamiltonian, and there's an interaction Hamiltonian. Mm-hmm. So you have some of those three terms. So then you can start with that and then go through this whole, go through the process, assuming that your weak coupling limit holds, et cetera, et cetera. You can try to derive the operators that you have in your Lindblad equation. What you'll find in general is that the thing is that's the unitary term, this term generates unitary evolution, isn't just the Hamiltonian of the system. It's kind of like a corrected Hamiltonian. It'll contain the Hamiltonian of the system terms, but it'll also contain some corrections which come from the interaction with the environment. So the unitary part here isn't just completely the original system Hamiltonian that you had. So the answer is, it's complicated, but when you sort of work out toy models, you see. So let's see what happens. It's called H, because it's basically that part on its own is generating unitary interactions. All right, so that's what happens. All right, any other questions? All right, so now I'm going to start to talk about philosophy. You know, the foundations of quantum mechanics, it's really at the intersection of physics, mathematics, and philosophy. Maybe even a little bit of computer science these days. But the point is that since the question that we're trying to answer, you know, what's up with quantum mechanics, people are often unclear about what that is. And philosophy is precisely the tool that we can use to get very, very clear on exactly what we're trying to achieve ultimately. So the main debate in the philosophy of science that's relevant to this question is the notion of realism versus anti-realism. So I want to spend a little bit of time talking about that. And I could spend, one of the reasons why I've made sure I've squeezed this into the last 15 minutes is because I would easily find myself talking about this for several hours, so, because it's interesting. All right, so far the approach we've basically taken to quantum theory is operational, right? We've treated measurements as a primitive in all this generalized formalism stuff. There's just measurements. There's something called a measurement. We're only really referring to probabilities of the outcomes experimental procedures. We're interested in predicting those. What's the mathematical formalism we use for that? So our goal here is to do something else. We want to try and make what's the central question that we're trying to answer in the foundations of quantum mechanics precise. So we're going to delve a bit into the philosophy of science. And, you know, I don't have time to spend a whole course doing this. You could, of course. This, I think, is the best textbook on the philosophy of science that really addresses the realism versus anti-realism debate as one of the core issues. Okay, so what do we mean by realism? Okay, so let's try and give a precise definition. And, you know, this is philosophy. So if you ask different philosophers what is scientific realism, you're going to get slightly different answers. There are many varieties of realism in the literature. I'm trying to simplify to the points that are most relevant for what we're doing here. So scientific realism, I'd say, has three key components. So first of all, there exists an objectively real physical world independent of observers, right? So the idea is that everything's not just in our minds, okay? So when I leave this room, or when we all leave this room and there are no observers left in this room, there are still tables and chairs in this room. They exist independently of us. If all intelligent life was suddenly wiped out from the universe, there would still be stars and planets and all that kind of stuff, okay? So most people probably believe that. I know, is there anybody here who doesn't believe that? 50-50, okay. Then the second thing is, of course, okay, it's one thing to say that such a thing exists. Now what's the relevance to physics? Well, the job of a physical theory is to attempt to describe it. This word here is pretty key, attempt to describe it, because obviously the history of science has shown that we haven't really necessarily arrived at the final theory yet, right? So if there is such a thing as a final theory, according to this point of view, it would be an accurate description of the objectively existing world. We have no reason to believe that quantum theory, quantum field theory, is the final theory, but it is an attempt to describe the world. And so then theories of physics that are successful are approximately correct descriptions of this objectively physical, real physical world. So we think of the progression of physical theories as increasingly accurate and precise, approximate descriptions of what's really going on out there. So on this point of view, if there are entities that appear in your theories, such as electrons and quarks, these refer to things that you can't directly see with your, like, they're not, you know, they're theoretical entities. I don't directly see them. But it's more accurate if my theory involves these things. Since my theory is an approximately correct description of the physical world, it's more accurate to walk around thinking that electrons and quarks and things like that actually exist and they're actually out there than it is to do otherwise. Okay? So maybe the world isn't exactly made of quarks and electrons and things like that. Maybe it's made of strings or whatever. It's a good approximation of the actual reality to think of these things actually floating around out there. Okay. So that's realism. Any questions on what that means? All right. Let me say a few things about what realism is not, because if you look in the literature on quantum foundations, the term realism is banded about with all kinds of different meanings. So realism in the philosophical sense does not mean any of these things. It does not mean that all quantum observables must have definite values at all times. That's some kind of outcome determinism. All outcomes. Realism is perfectly compatible with there being some kind of genuine stochasticity in nature, right? It doesn't mean that the quantum state is necessarily a description of reality. It obviously means that something in our theory should be a description of reality, but that might not be the quantum state. You might have this sort of psi epistemic point of view where this is more like a probability distribution. It does not mean nature must be deterministic, as I said. It also doesn't mean our theories are literally true, right? Because some people argue against realism by saying, well, obviously no theory in the past has been true because we've always had to replace theories with new ones. So thinking that these are descriptions of reality in any way is obviously balmy, right? But the important point is we're only thinking of them, trying to think about them as a succession of approximate descriptions of reality. Okay, so I would say it's much harder to deny real realism. You can still argue against it, but this is, if you think about what you thought about physics before you really learned any quantum mechanics, you probably thought something along these lines. For most people, it takes quantum mechanics to like even think of shifting away from this kind of point of view. Okay, so anti-realism. Well, if you read the literature on the philosophy of quantum mechanics, most people who study the philosophy of quantum mechanics, not all, but most, are realists. So the anti-realist, there are various varieties of anti-realism: idealism, logical positivism, empiricism, instrumentalism, operationalism. These are things that you will see in the literature. Usually when you see them in the literature, they're intended as insults. Like somebody says, oh, you're a logical positivist and that's bad. Like the distinction between these different terms is not often really, and I'm not gonna make the distinction between these different terms. They have slightly different, they have slightly different ideas about what science is about, but we will sort of kind of skirt over those distinctions for now. But basically, the starting point here is that, well, okay, the only things that you have direct access to are your own perceptions. So you might emphasize an individual person's perceptions. That would be what you do in, say, idealism, for instance. Or you might more emphasize the records of results from experimental apparatuses, right? So you might consider reliable, you know, if I have a printout of the results of some experiment, you might say, okay, that's an experimental record. That's objective, everybody agrees on it, right? So it's a slightly difference of emphasis. Then, those are the things that we know exist. We can see them directly, we all agree on them, we can publish results of experimental apparatuses in journals, have a record of them for everybody to see. So that's the ground base of agreement for everything, okay? So then the point of view is that whatever theories are, they're simply systems for organizing or predicting regularities in those things. Okay, those are the things that obviously really exist, and theories are just our way of organizing them. And that implies that theoretical entities, so something like an electron, I don't directly see an electron, right? I can sometimes see photons that scatter off an electron, but nobody's ever really seen one electron, right? So they're convenient fiction which are used in our calculations, right? So we develop some kind of calculus of electrons to summarize basically the regularities that we see in our observed experiments. So one particular variety here this is often the one that's actually gets used in the literature despite all these other terms. So operationalism, for instance, says that every statement of a theory should boil down to a list of instructions for what to do in the lab and what will be seen as a result, okay? So if I say something like, I don't know, the position of an electron at time t is x, then what that really means is, you know, if I construct a coordinate system in this particular way out of pieces of wood, you know, pointing in three different directions, and I take a ruler which is constructed in such and such a way and I put it right here, then I will find that the electron is at this number along the ruler, right? Then I will find some kind of signal here, right? The point is that you're supposed that all of these theoretical statements should ultimately boil down to something that I could go do in the lab and just verify objectively independent of, that everybody would agree on what that is. Okay, so that's anti-realism. So let me see. Okay, 5 minutes or so. What I want to do is give some of the arguments that are given for these positions. So let's start with realism. So obviously there's many arguments that are given pro and contra these things. It's a big, complicated debate. So I'm just going to give one argument. So this argument is due to Hilary Putnam. It's sometimes, by some people, thought of as one of the strongest arguments for realism. It is basically called the no miracles argument. Okay, so he says, when they argue for their position, realists typically argue against some version of idealism. There he probably means that as an insult, I imagine. In our time, this would be positivism or operationalism. See, these isms come all over the place, right? And the typical realist argument against idealism is that it makes the success of science a miracle. Okay, so what he says is the modern positivist has to leave it without explanation, the realist charges, that electron calculi and space-time calculi and DNA calculi correctly predict observable phenomena if in reality there are no electrons, no curved spacetime, and no DNA molecules. If there are such things, then a natural explanation for the success of theories is that they are partially true accounts of how they behave. And a natural account of the way scientific theories succeed each other is that a partially correct, incorrect account of a theoretical object is replaced by a better account of the same object or objects. But if those objects don't really exist at all, then it is a miracle that a theory which speaks of gravitational actions at a distance successfully predicts phenomena. It's a miracle that a theory which speaks of curved space-time successfully predicts phenomena. And the fact that the laws of the former theory are derivable in the limit from the laws of the latter has no methodological significance. Okay, so he's first of all, he's arguing 2 points here. So the first point is that if these things don't exist at all, then why should stories about them have anything to do with our predictions? Why should the predictions that we make or the regularities in the world be organized in such a way that you can describe them by, for example, electromagnetism, which posits the existence of electrons? But then he's making a second point at all, which is that it seems to be that in the progress of science, we do get to successively more accurate theories. So he's talking about the replacement of Newtonian gravity with general relativity here. And in general relativity, you can derive the appropriateness of Newtonian gravity in an approximate limit. But if you're an anti-realist, there seems to be no real reason why there should be this kind of continuity of concepts between successive theories. Why wouldn't the next theory just use its own completely different concepts? Why should you expect to derive one thing from the other in the limits? After all, the regularities could be whatever they are. Okay, so that's called the no miracles argument. This is an argument from Arthur Eddington. Eddington, you probably, if you know who Arthur Eddington is, you probably know him as the guy who confirmed Einstein's general relativity by looking at the deflection of stars around the bending of light from stars around the sun in an eclipse. He was an experimentalist. Later in life, he started to write what we would now call popular science books. But if you read popular science books from like 1930s, 1940s, they're much more technical than modern popular science books. Something happened. So in modern parlance, this would be regarded as probably an academic philosophy textbook. At the time, it was written for a public audience. Okay. So here's sort of defending anti-realism here. So he says, let's suppose that an ichthyologist, this is somebody who studies sea creatures, okay, is exploring the life of the ocean. He casts a net into the water and brings up a fishy assortment. Surveying his catch, he proceeds in the usual manner of a scientist to systematize what it reveals. He arrives at two generalizations. One, no sea creature is less than 2 inches long. Two, all sea creatures have gills. These are both true of his catch, and he assumes tentatively that they will remain true however often he repeats it. In applying this analogy, the catch stands for the body of knowledge which constitutes physical science, and the net for the sensory and intellectual equipment which we use in obtaining it. The casting of the net corresponds to observation. For knowledge which has not been or could not be obtained by observation is not admitted into physical science. A non-looker may object that the first generalization is wrong. There are plenty of sea creatures under 2 inches long, only your net is not adapted to catch them. The ichthyologist dismisses this objection contemptuously. Anything uncatchable by my net is ipso facto outside the scope of ichthyological knowledge. In short, what my net can't catch isn't fish. Or to translate the analogy, if you are not simply guessing, you are claiming a knowledge of the physical universe discovered in some other way than the methods of physical science, and admittedly unverifiable by such methods. You are a metaphysician. Bah. I don't know if it's such a bad thing to be a metaphysician, but for a physicist, it obviously is. So this is kind of a funny story, because when you start reading this story, you might expect him to be cautioning against saying that what you can measure is all that exists, because obviously there are sea creatures under 2 inches long. But no, he turns and makes the other point. The point is, it's obviously true that we can only theorize about things that we can measure. So what he's saying here is that the process of measurement or the process of perceiving something, that's the primary thing. That's the content of physical theories. Okay. I don't know if you agree with that, but obviously, if it were in ethology, fundamentally impossible to ever make a net with holes less than 2 inches wide, if it turned out that there was some fundamental limitation against doing it, then you may agree that, well, since I can only investigate objects of this size, those are the only ones that it makes sense to say scientifically exist in any way, right? Even though there might be all sorts of other stuff. Okay, I've run out of time. So I will talk a little bit more about these two points of view and how I think they should be fit together at the beginning of tomorrow before we move on. Any questions? Okay.